And today is the anniversary of the first draft lottery in the U.S. since the Second World War. Here's how it sounded on December 1st, 1969.
Because of the CBS News special report which follows, Mayberry RFD will not be presented tonight, but will return next week at its regularly scheduled time over most of these stations. The Draft Lottery, a live report on tonight's picking of the birth dates for the draft.
And then numbers corresponding to dates were pulled from a big bowl and read out. Where your birth date was in this lottery could determine whether or not you went to Vietnam. Let's back up. In 1969, all young men had to register for the draft when they turned 18. They still do, but back then all had to serve unless they received exemptions, like going to college, which people began to realize was incredibly classist. Not everyone could afford college. In the late 60s, the unpopular Vietnam War was escalating. Thousands of young men were coming home in caskets. The Nixon administration wanted to move to a volunteer military and expand the pool of recruits, so the draft lottery was instituted, dates called out on live television.
February 14th.
It was a lottery that felt like a Hunger Games for 18 to 26-year-olds. If your number was low, there was a good chance you'd be drafted unless you could find a deferment like grad school or bad feet. At one fraternity house at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire, one young man super glued boots to his feet for months to try to get a deferment. He was at one of the animal houses, you know, like the movie. But in real life, at least some members of Herrett House went from beer-soaked party animals to sober activists concerned about an unpopular war and an unfair system that had protected them from military service. One of them was Dennis O'Neill, now a screenwriter and journalist. We spoke in 2013 when he'd written a fictional account of his time at Dartmouth, Whiplash, when the Vietnam War rolled a hand grenade into the animal house. It was based on true accounts of some Dartmouth grads who were coming back in body bags. Not all sought deferment. Dennis also started a website for others to share their memories of where they were when their number was called in the lottery. And at the time we asked Dennis, what was the mood on this day in 1969 on campus?
Well, a lot of foreboding, needless to say, because Dartmouth had been pretty much a road trip culture, a lot of animal house shenanigans. But at this point, all of a sudden, for seniors, you know, after 3 years of protective custody at Hanover, New Hampshire, you're looking at the very real possibility of going to Vietnam, getting called up if you drew a low draft number. So there was a lot of anxiety that year, first class ever to graduate with a diploma and a draft number.
Well, even as you say this, it reminds us also of the culture war that was ignited around this, because there were a lot of people who weren't privileged enough to go to college who were serving, who were marching down to the draft board because they didn't have exemptions.
Well, that was true, Robin. And I think actually one of the reasons why they put the lottery in was an attempt to correct the imbalance. I think that's one of the driving reasons behind the draft lottery, that it would make it more equitable. And ironically, after the draft, it actually turned more students against the war.
How did this draft lottery work?
Well, it was surreal, for one thing, because it looked like a bingo match, you know, low tech. It took place at Selective Service Headquarters. General Hershey was in charge, and they literally put 366, a leap day, numbers representing a day of the year in blue capsules and put them all into a big fishbowl, and they were pulled out by different people. That night, it turns out, Dartmouth was playing Norwich Military Academy in a hockey game. And so most of the evening for me was taking place on the ice in this very surreal atmosphere where the fraternity brothers with transistor radios were shouting out the draft numbers as the seniors would look up from the ice, from the puck, into the stands. I didn't realize till much, much later what the score of the game was, because the bigger game that night was being played in the stands and was being broadcast from Washington, D.C.
Yeah. Young women crying because they were thinking of their boyfriends, their brothers, families, parents gathered around TV sets. This was a national—I mean, I mentioned Hunger Games. It feels like Hunger Games. Everybody was watching.
Well, I think everybody my age remembers exactly where they were, and every fraternity at Dartmouth went into a bunker mode, and the televisions were dragged up into the living rooms, and everybody set up basically a mock draft, and the names of the seniors were put up on billboards, and as the numbers were pulled out, you know, there would be a sigh of relief or a moan or a groan. And I never forget after that night, Robin, and I'm sure everybody had a similar memory of that night when your number finally was called. I was 163, which wasn't good. But this scene in the basement of Parrot House, we repaired there, and on the bar top was this kid from Coleraine, Minnesota, Kent Nyberg, and he had drawn number 366, the leap day, and he was not going to war, and he had bought the keg for the house, and he'd basically drunk himself into a happy stupor. And on the other side of the room was this kid from Maine, and he'd drawn number 14, and he was sobbing uncontrollably, and he was being consoled by his girlfriend. But those two images that night in the basement of Herod, after December 1st at Dartmouth, really, and on any other campus in America, it became a tale of two campuses. If you drew the low number, you were either going to war or you had to figure out how to get out of the war. And if you drew the high number, you were home free.
Let's listen to some of the accounts that you're getting at your website, whiplashthebook.com. Let's listen.
My lottery number was 18. I was a dead man walking.
Ultimately, I ended up being number 280, totally in the safe category.
As it turned out, my number was 354, and I was relieved, to be honest, but I couldn't be very joyous about it.
That's photojournalist James Nottway. Before him, filmmaker Bill Idalot, composer Mason Daring. Dennis O'Neill, talk about the culture war aspect of this, because many of the college students, when they got low draft numbers, then started frantically trying to get a deferment. And they knew doctors, their dads had connections. You got a deferment. But many blue-collar kids couldn't. The college kids had been protected.
But we were protected. We were sheltered, you know, under the university umbrella. And for me, I was conflicted because both of my parents had fought in World War II. They were in the OSS. But my dad was completely dead set against this war. And he would stand in front of the flagpole in Westport, Connecticut, my hometown, every Sunday morning in silent protest to the war. And he knew that the generals were lying, and he knew that it was the wrong war. And so he encouraged me to do whatever I would have to do to avoid going over there. But I felt guilty about it because I knew others were going.
Well, you described some of the things that people did. They ate to gain yes. gain weight. The fellow who put boots on for months to, it's just disgusting. Some took drugs. What were some of the other things?
There was a whole range. You know, at Dartmouth, the fraternities became bunkers of draft evasion. And one boy started eating mac and cheese. He would go down to the big box store and get like a 50-pound chunk of cheddar and then, you know, massive bags of noodles, and he just started eating. He put on 50 pounds. He had an idea that if he could eat enough, he would get out for obesity, which he did. The boy who put the super glue on his boots ended up with a pretty good mushroom patch when he opened up those boots in Manchester.
At the draft board.
Hypertension.
Yeah, at the draft board.
And, of course, as we know, eventually the street protests had an effect and helped bring the war to a close.
Well, the other thing that helped with kids who were getting exemptions at draft boards is that many of the doctors who were doing the exams agreed.
The chief medical officer at Manchester was a guy, a young guy, radiologist from La Jolla, California. He was happy to see as many kids get off as possible. It was just the luck of the draw at that draft board.
But, I'm hearing that, but I can't help but thinking of the young men first of all, there were young men who wanted to go, but the young men who may not have wanted to go and really had none of these choices.
That's absolutely right, Robin. And I felt a burden, really, in taking the train back from New Haven to Bridgeport. You know, they were tough neighborhoods that I went through, and I knew that those kids, you know, were serving in my place. But I also knew that some Dartmouth kids had gone and given their lives as well. So it wasn't a good assignment for anybody. Mm. But because I felt privileged, I felt that fate had intervened and I had gotten out, and that maybe because of that, I should try to make something of myself. I tried to turn it into a crossroad in my life that made me be a little more grateful for what I had and possibly head off in a useful direction.
No more Animal House. Well, but meantime, what do you want people to do now?
Well, I think it's a useful conversation to have, especially when we have a country that seems to be perpetually involved in one war or another. You know, whether a draft would be useful to help deter some of that warfare, or whether some sort of national service would be useful. But I think when you go back and you remember, and I think when you have a conversation about the draft and what it meant and who went and who didn't go and who didn't come back and who came back in a body bag, It kind of usefully advances the conversation about this seemingly perpetual war footing that we're on these days.
Well, it's also a reminder of a night when everyone was glued to television or radio trying to hear their number.
And Robin, what was so interesting when we thought about it is how fate had intervened. What if you were twins and one of you was born a minute before midnight and the other 2 minutes after midnight? One got the low number, one got the high number. There was so much fate involved in it. And no matter what you had done in your life up until then, it didn't matter. They pulled this ball out of a fishbowl in Washington, D.C., and because of that, your life changed dramatically.
Yeah. Dennis, thanks so much.
My pleasure, Robin. Thank you.